until that spirit had gotten her shattered by the demon Fossa. Aulan was so much like her. So much like Shona's dead sister.
6. Matinee.
A full month, the huge, shaggy man said, shaking his head and grinning his near-toothless smile.
2 if I tarry, Talmadge replied.
All the way to the mountains? Mountains in the west?
Mountains you cannot see from here, said Talmadge.
I leave about Midsummer's Day, but I'll be in good fortune to get to the lower mountain trails before the end of Octumbra.
That brought a snort and a headshake.
A month and a half, if you're lucky.
Talmadge shrugged.
Mountains as tall as those splitting vanguard from Alpinador?
The large man asked.
Again, Talmadge shrugged. I've never been to those, nor to Vanguard, nor even over the mountains that mark the rim of the Wilderlands. But those mountains are as far to the east from here as I am walking west.
The big man chuckled, and looked about the gigantic tent of the Matinee, the yearly spring gathering of the women and men who roamed the western wilds, hunting and trading, and here trading stories of the long winter, speaking rumours of those who weren't there, or of those who had gone back to the east to more civilized lands, or of those who had passed on from this life. He pointed to one handsome and sturdy young woman, nodded his head, and pointed to Talmadge.
You should be taking that one along for company, he said.
I take no one for company.
Talmadge's face turned stern as he said that. In the 8 years since the Badger incident, he had steadfastly refused any requests to accompany him on his now fabled annual and arduous footslog.
Better than curling up with a bear,
the shaggy man wheezed. Talmadge lifted his cup of foamy ale and gave a nod, even though he had no intention of making any exceptions, man or woman. He'd have enough of the company of his peers over the next couple of months, roaming the trails, hunting, trading and bartering, collecting trinkets he thought might be of interest to the lakemen of Lochbeag, a market that was exclusively his own to exploit. The other nomadic traders of the frontier couldn't get enough of the pearls Talmadge brought back from the tribes. Many would pocket the pearls they had traded for this very week at Matinee, and rush to the east, to the outskirts of Hans the Bear, and there profit handsomely. The shaggy trader downed his ale and stumbled towards the kegs for some more, and Talmadge was glad to be rid of him, and of the stench of his breath. He glanced again at the woman the big man had indicated, and lifted his mug in a toast as she met his gaze. He wouldn't take her with him, and she probably wouldn't want to go, for few would, and most thought Talmadge crazy for making the dangerous trek year after year. But he wasn't leaving before Midsummer, and perhaps a bit of womanly company would do him good. She certainly didn't seem put off by his apparent interest. So perhaps it was time to make that interest more obvious.
Hotai Tsensen, Talmadge echoed. That's an interesting name. Perhaps I am an interesting woman.
Hotai replied with a grin. Talmadge nodded, not about to disagree. Hotai Tsensen was taller than most of the men at Matinee, and there was nothing scrawny about her arms and shoulders, her muscles solid and imposing beyond the limits of her sleeveless and quite revealing vest. Her long hair was dark, her small eyes dark, her face round and flat, and strangely inviting. Talmadge had never seen anyone who looked quite like her, and he was sure she had never before been at Matinee in those weeks he had attended the festival. This woman he would not have forgotten.
"How long have you been hunting the frontier?" he asked.
"I'm not, really," she replied,
placing her forearms on the back of a chair and leaning forward toward Talmadge.
"I only come to the Matinee to see what I can bring back to my village."
Talmadge cocked his head, intrigued.
"Beyond the southern mountains, in the foothills on the south face," she explained.
"The steps?"
"Togai, yes."
"You are Togai Ru?"
Talmadge asked, trying unsuccessfully to hide his surprise.
There were some Togai Ru, the famed and ferocious horsemen of the steppes, at Matani year after year, but Talmadge hadn't considered that. Now that Korte had mentioned it, though, he could see the similarities, particularly in the woman's ruddy colouring and the shape of her face.
"A bit," she answered. "My father is. My mother is half of Beren and half of Alpinador."
"What?" Talmadge blurted, before he could find the sense to hold his tongue, and he silently cursed those last two mugs of ale as perhaps too many. But Korte laughed happily, obviously taking no offence.
"A strange mix, aye," she said. "My grandfather was a pirate. He probably still is."
"So you hail from the frozen north, the eastern deserts, and the southern steppes, yet speak the language of the central kingdom of Hans the Bear as well as I?"
"All points blended into the middle," she asked,
and Talmadge laughed and lifted his mug, but only took a sip. He didn't want to be especially drunk right now.
"I speak Togai Ru," she said,
and translated it to Hindhok Finyar, and Berenice, Shonton Hayas Siha. She narrowed her eyes, painted on a wicked little grin, and lowered her voice to add, "Rid Bolta, Alpinadorin.
Yagar Til Den Sang," she said in a husky voice,
and though Talmadge spoke not a word of the barbarian language, and so did not understand, with her inflection and suggestive body language, he surely understood her meaning. Before he could reconsider, he brought his ale to his lips and swallowed the whole of it in one great gulp. He was fumbling in his thoughts for how he might accept the invitation, if that's what it was, and he was pretty certain that it was, when a cry erupted over at the far side of the gigantic tent.
"Red Shanks!"
More than one, more than 10 voices raised. Both Talmadge and Korte turned about to see the man, and both couldn't help but smile. Redshanks was known, by name at least, to everyone on the frontier, with tall tales of his godlike exploits growing taller at every matinee. He'd lived with bears, danced with wolves, worn living leopards as scarves, sucked the poison out of a mountain viper's fangs, dulled the hats of powries, castrated giants with his teeth, caught lightning and thrown it back, and yelled louder than the thunder for good measure. He could outspit, outfight, outlaugh, outsing, outdance, outrun, outclimb, outswim, outhunt, outfish, and outswive any man or woman alive. And those were his least achievements. He came into the big tent, dancing a quick-legged jig, wearing his trademark kilt and bright red knee stockings to match his red beret, a Powry's own bloody cap, no less. All the people nearest rushed to share their flagons with him, wanting the honour of having Redshanks himself drinking from their cups. Talmadge watched it all with a widening grin as Redshanks, the legend, took control of the festivities in the great tent.
"You know him?"
Korte asked, jarring the lanky frontiersman from the spectacle.
"Redshanks? No. I've seen him a couple of times, years ago, but never more than from afar."
"He's not been to Matinee in several years," said Korte. "But he's been about the mountains in the south."
She turned a sly eye to Talmadge.
"Would you like to meet him?"
"You know him."
"Very well," she replied,
and in a way that brought a twinge of jealousy to Talmadge, surprising him. As if to prove her point, Redshanks came bounding over then. He took Korte by the arm and swung her about, the two launching into a spinning and dipping dance as smoothly as if they'd been practicing together for years. The crowd cheered and took up a song, and by the time the couple had finished, Korte's forehead was wet with perspiration. The much older Redshanks, though, seemed barely winded. After the bows and final cheers, Korte wouldn't let go of the man's hand and dragged him over to Talmadge.
"My old friend, this is..."
She paused and looked at the lanky frontiersman curiously.
"Talmadge!"
Talmadge blurted, realizing that he hadn't yet gotten around to telling Korte his name.
"He's to blame for the..."
Korte started.
"The pearls,"
Redshanks said.
"Aye, the pearls.
Talmadge could hardly catch his breath, overwhelmed that this legend knew anything at all about him.
"I'm off for a drink," said Corte.
"Make it three, then," Redshanks bade her. "Tell him one's for me, and get yourself a better price."
He turned right back to Talmadge.
"Your pearls have found their way along the roads to haunts," he said.
"Forgive my confusion, sir, but I don't remember ever trading them with you, or anything with you."
"They find their way to my purse anyway," Redshanks explained. "From them who are not going far enough to the east to make good use of the things. Too few folk in the wilder lands to put so many of the gems in there. So, I get them, and cheap. But hey, I'm not selling them cheap in Palmaris and Ursel."
Talmadge's eyes sparkled. Palmaris and Ursel, the two largest cities in the kingdom of Hans the Bear, with more people in either than he'd ever seen in his life, likely.
"Where are you from, Mr. Talmadge? You wouldn't know it. Try me."
Talmadge had to spend a moment composing himself. His former home was not a name he often spoke, nor even recalled, for with it always came the pain of watching his family wither and die.
"It was called Westhaven," he said somberly.
Redshanks seemed to deflate a bit, and issued an audible sigh.
"The rosy plague," he said quietly.
Talmadge stared at him, caught by surprise. Westhaven was little more than a tiny hamlet on the western edge of the westernmost forest of the Wilderlands. In his childhood and early teenage years living there, Talmadge had seen no more than a handful of visitors, if that. He gave a slight nod.
"You're one of the few from that doomed place still living, would be my guess," said Redshanks.
Talmadge nodded again, and was glad when Corte returned with three flagons. She handed them out and led a toast.
"You must have been but a boy," Redshanks remarked.
"A very young man," Talmadge answered to the old frontiersman's nod.
"What?"
asked Corte.
"You've been out here ever since?"
"Just a few months longer than my time in Westhaven," Talmadge replied.
"What?"
Corte asked again.
"Wasn't a choice then, but just the way you walked," said Redshanks.
Talmadge nodded, and Corte shied back a bit and quieted. No doubt from the somber look on his face, Talmadge thought.
"Do you miss it?"
He kept nodding.
"I'll be going back that way when this damned party's over," Redshanks said. "Road's wide enough for two."
He paused and offered a wide smile at Corte.
"For three, even."
Talmadge shook his head.
"You can, you know," said Redshanks. "The plague's long gone now. Gone a decade and more. And there's so much fighting and dying over in Hans that none are bothered to look to the western lands. Things are troubled in Ursel in God's year 846, aye. And troubled times are profitable times for a young man with good wits. How would you know my wits? Still alive, ain't you? Aye. Alive and finding your way to Fearachspuer, and not many can do that and come back, eh?"
Talmadge's jaw drooped open in surprise. How could he know that detail?
"You think old Redshanks hadn't gotten himself a few of those pearls on his own?"
Redshanks answered before Talmadge could ask. The older man, and he had to be at least 60, Talmadge thought, and maybe closer to 80, laughed.
"I knew the 8 tribes before you knew how to open your eyes. Of course, there were 11 tribes then, but we both know the dangers there, eh?"
Talmadge nodded. Across the room, someone called out for a Redshanks dance.
"Think about it," Redshanks offered,
and he gave a slight bow to Talmadge and moved off to greet some other old acquaintances. The unexpected honour he had just been paid, along with the startling information, had Talmadge feeling as if a slight breeze would knock him to the floor. He closed his eyes and tried to replay that surreal conversation. He didn't have to think about Redshank's offer, though, for returning to the East wasn't a new proposition to him. In the year after the death of Badger, Talmadge had learned that Hans the Bear had become peaceful and prosperous, and by all accounts civilized under the guidance of good King Danube and good Queen Gilsepone. Certainly, that would have been the perfect time for Talmadge to go home, or to find a new home in the easier lands to the east. But Talmadge wasn't out here in the dangerous wilds because of any crime that had gotten him chased out, like many of those around him, but because he felt pressed in by large gatherings of people. Even here in Matinee, he was pushing his emotional limits, and so couldn't wait to be back on the trail.
"So, where are you going then?"
Cote asked, drawing him from his contemplations.
"What?"
he replied, but then added, "To the west, as soon as I've done some trading, that I can gather supplies and goods."
"Alone?"
Talmadge started to respond, but the tone of her voice stopped him, sounding very much as if she was offering to go along. Or maybe not quite that, but surely there was a hint in there, as in her eyes as she stared into his, as in her inviting smile. "What about him?" Talmadge asked, regretting the jealous question as soon as the words slipped past his lips.
"Who? Redshanks?"
Cote said with a light-hearted laugh, and she turned to regard the man.
"You two seemed quite friendly."
"He's a bit old, but I'd be a liar if I told you I wasn't ever interested."
"Then why not?"
Cote laughed again.
"Redshanks isn't interested in ladies beyond dancing," she answered.
Talmadge's face twisted with confusion and surprise.
"But his reputation..."
"Mostly earned and mostly true," Cote said. "Mostly."
Talmadge drank his ale in one great gulp. He simply couldn't help it.
"I wouldn't mind a few more dances,"
Cote offered.
I don't..."
"Oh, by the truth of the winter wind, you do," she said,
and grabbed his hand and dragged him out for a twirl. And before Talmadge could pull away, the room erupted in song once more, led, loudest of all, of course, by Redshanks, who did indeed have a marvellous singing voice, to no one's surprise. Truly, it was the best matinee Talmadge had ever enjoyed, and over the next few weeks he got to know Cote very well, and realized that the initial promise of and attraction to the woman was nothing compared to the truth of her. Still, when he set out for the west on Midsummer's Day, he walked alone. Bits of the thick rope he had used to hang Badger from the tree were still there, he knew, and he'd see that grim reminder when he passed, and could probably even find the bones of the man below if he decided to look. Even though he had come to yearn for this unusual and formidable woman who lived in Togai, Talmadge wanted more to keep the winds of Lochbjog separate and solitary, his personal refuge from all the ugliness of the civilized world. 7. Hunt.
"I know what you plan," Ynniva said, sweeping through some tangled branches to find a young couple huddled in a pine tree cave in the slave barracks.
The two stared at her, wide-eyed. These two, a young woman of 15 years and a boy nearing manhood, had been slaves to the Uskar longer than the 8 years of Ynniva's indenture. They were not from Ynniva's village, evidenced by the double-humped shape of their heads, the wrapping practice more common in the westernmost village of Kar Sailach, and in the easternmost settlement of Selad Tulloch. The boy held up his hands helplessly, his expression quite panicked, but the young woman merely smiled disarmingly.
"What do we plan?"
she asked.
"You are running," Ynniva flatly stated.
"That would be foolish,"
said the young woman, as the boy issued a small whimper.
"Where would we go?"
Ynniva sighed and looked behind her, even poked her head up and out from the overlapping branches to ensure that no one else was about.
"I do not blame you. I'll not dissuade you," she said,
when she came fully into the natural chamber once more. She looked at the young woman with deep sympathy and said, "You were visited." The woman's face twitched. Truly, she seemed just a frightened girl at that moment,
and she seemed to be holding back tears.
"We are not running," the boy blurted. "We're not that stupid. Only your own son is that..."
"Psh!" the young woman chided, slugging him on the back of his shoulder.
"I do not blame you,"
Ineva said again, calmly and evenly. She wasn't upset that the boy thought Thump stupid, of course. She could only hope the Uskar believed it as well, for that ruse was her dear child's only chance to survive.
"And I will help," Ineva promised.
"You wish to come?"
the boy said, his tone somewhere between terrified and hopeful. Ineva laughed sadly and shook her head.
"I am visited every day and every night," she explained. "You'd not get much of a lead on our captors, were I to go." She looked at the young woman, the girl, with deepest sympathy at the reminder that this one, too, would soon enough suffer such a fate as Ineva.
Only one warrior had taken this young woman, a mere girl, thus far. But word would soon enough spread among the savage, insatiable Uskar demons.
"What is your name?"
Ineva asked the woman.
"Sandashe, I have heard."
The woman nodded.
"He is Dunan Bloch. We are from Selat Tulloch, above the low desert."
Ineva nodded.
"You should not try to get there. Not straight away. Go straight down the mountain to Fasach Cran, my village. If you can get among the huts, use my name. Remind them that I was the wife of Juana Kahl. Tell them you have come with my blessing. My people will protect you."
The youngsters looked to each other uncertainly, then back at Ineva, and she saw more than a little skepticism painted on their faces.
"Just get off Fyrach Spwer," Ineva told the boy pointedly. "And soon. We both know why," she added to the young woman, drawing her attention to her young companion.
Dunan Bloch would soon be a man, and thus a threat, and perhaps even a temptation to the Uskar women. And so his time grew short. He would surely be killed later that same year, when the tribe returned to the Winter Plateau, and most horribly. Dunan Bloch looked back and forth between the nodding women, his expression growing desperate.
"I do not want to go alone," he said, suddenly gasping for breath.
"It is not just for him," Sandashe said, and put a comforting hand on Dunan Bloch's shoulder.
"No," Ineva agreed.
"And even if he weren't here, my counsel would be for you to run. I know what your life among the Uskar will be."
"You wish to come with us?"
the boy accused.
"I already told you that I cannot,"
Ineva calmly replied.
"But yes, I wish I could. So many times have I thought of running, of even casting myself from a high rock, every day for 8 years. But I cannot."
"Because of your son," Sandashe said quietly. "The stupid one," Dunan Bloch said. And Sandashe slugged him in the shoulder again.
"Because of Thump, yes," Ineva said.
She looked Sandashe right in the eye, forcing her to lock stares, and added,
"And that is why I have come to you."
Dunan Bloch seemed at a loss, but the young woman's expression of surprise only lasted a moment.
"You wish us to take your son," she stated.
"He will not be missed before you are missed," Ineva said.
"He is a Fasach Cran. His mother, Ineva, his father, Juana Kahl. He will ensure your safety there until my people, his people, can take you home across the waters to Selat Tulloch."
"We cannot..."
Dunan Bloch started to argue, but Sandashe hit him again to silence him.
"Thump is swift and sure-footed, and he knows the ways of the mountain," Ineva assured them. "I must get him away before..."
She looked at Dunan Bloch and winced, then closed her eyes to compose herself and find her courage. This boy, who was almost a man, sitting before her, had waited too long, she feared. He knew his fate. And surely the Uskar knew that he knew his fate. They wouldn't be surprised to discover that he had run off. It was a desperate plan, to be sure, and one riddled with traps.
and so Inava almost reconsidered asking them to take Thump along. But there weren't many Umas in between the ages of Thump and this boy, Dunnenbloch, and so Inava feared that this might be her last chance to save her child, desperate as it seemed.
"Take my boy with you," she said determinedly. "I will lie for you when they come looking. I will say that one of the women came for you, all three, and sent you out on an errand to collect pine cones."
Sander Shea didn't blink, and Inava couldn't tell if she was getting through to the young woman or not.
"Dunnenbloch and I will speak of it," Sander Shea finally said.
"We can't be slowed," the boy interjected.
Inava started to plead, to argue, but Sander Shea cut her short with an upraised hand.
"There is much to consider, and we have time. We'll not be leaving for many days still."
Dunnenbloch started to respond again, but Sander Shea cut him off forcefully, with a look, a punch, and a growl. Inava tried to decipher that, but she understood that there was little more she could do at that time. She nodded respectfully to the young woman and backed away, pausing only briefly to try to hear any residual comments. And indeed, Dunnenbloch started to speak, but again was cut short by his co-conspirator. Worry followed Inava, all the way back to her tree cave.
"She said she would lie to them to help us," Dunnenbloch said, when Sander Shea scouted about and confirmed that they were alone once more.
The boy was shaking his head as he spoke, though, clearly struggling with this new dilemma.
"If we are being pursued, we should go to Fasach Cran," Sander Shea said. "Inava helped us by telling us.
So, we should bring her stupid boy?"
Sander Shea cast a pensive glance in the direction Inava had gone, and chewed her lip, hating her answer even as she shook her head.
"He'll slow us down," Dunnenbloch went on,
unaware that she was agreeing with him.
"And he's ugly. He looks like them, like the ugly Uskar demons."
Sander Shea turned and cast a glare of consternation at the boy.
"Every time I see him, I want to kick him," Dunnenbloch admitted.
"He's not Uskar," Sander Shea quietly reminded. "He's just Umas, like us. And if we could take him, I would."
Dunnenbloch started to reply, but paused and looked at the young woman curiously.
"But you agree we will not?"
"I do," she said. "And we go this very night."
"But you told the long-haired woman."
"Exactly,"
Sander Shea said, and she sighed. She had lied to Inava, to give her and Dunnenbloch space to get away. She looked back in the direction of Inava's tree cave, and towards the adjoining one of Inava's poor little boy as well. Truly, she wished she could get all the slaves out of the Uskar village, and to the safety of the lake, even those who were of tribes that often battled with the folk of Selat Tulloch, out on Loch Bjug. No one deserved this fate. Not the boys who would be worked to near death, and then tortured the rest of the way when they became men. And not the women, like Inava, and now like Sander Shea, who had to accept the violations of the ugly demon warriors. She wanted to take all the lakemen from this awful place. But she could not. She moved to the side and pushed a bed of needles out of her way, then dug in the soil to retrieve a bag of food she had cleverly stashed. Then, her expression grim and determined, Sander Shea reached out for Dunnenbloch's hand. It was time to go. Quite a commotion greeted Aulin when she went out into the camp that morning. People hustled all about, whispering excitedly. To the side of the encampment stood the Umas, in a line, and with a long rope binding them all together ankle to ankle. Aulin couldn't miss the nervousness on their faces, all of them, including Thump, who seemed absolutely mortified.
"A runner,"
she heard the crone mutter, the woman coming out right after Aulin.
"A pair of them,"
came an answer from the side. It took Aulin a few moments to sort that out.
"A runner?"
she whispered under her breath. She saw the warriors gathering, lifting weapons.
saw the witches of the coven hastily blessing those long and terrible spears, and then she understood. Now she looked at the line of Umas more carefully, and indeed two were missing. A young woman, only a few years older than she, and a boy of about her age. One of the men stepped before her, and it took her a moment to sort him out and recall his name, Raeth, a friend of the warrior named Ogmore, who had been kind to Aulan through the years. This one was very different, she thought, with his bulging muscles and stern face. He never seemed to smile. There was strength behind his scowl, she recognized, and fire behind his grey eyes, and Aulan found an unexpected tightness in her throat as she looked at him then in the morning light. He glanced over at her, and offered a grin she thought perfectly wicked, then nodded and hoisted his spear. He was eager to be on his way, she understood. He was eager for the hunt. He rushed off, sweeping up his friend Ogmore in his wake, the two of them moving fast to join the great warrior Te Arleg at the western end of the camp, at the mouth of the trail that led down Firoch's Buir. It surprised Aulan when Te Arleg looked over Breath's shoulder to her, his stare locking her gaze. She felt as if he was studying her too intently, as if he was looking into her heart and soul in his mind. She did not like that feeling at all, particularly now after the strange and unknown reaction she had felt in staring at the other strong warrior. She closed up a bit, moving her arms across her chest, and Te Arleg gave a little laugh, nodded to his charges, and ran off. Aulan stood there, watching them go, still postured defensively, unblinking. "Don't worry," said the crone, coming up beside her. "They will catch the fleeing Umas." Aulan nodded, but for her teacher's sake only, because in her heart she was afraid of that very thing, that the warriors would catch the runners. Awed by the magic in their crystalline weapon tips, the small hunting party led by Te Arleg streamed along the mountain trails, weaving through copses of trees and scrambling over boulder tumbles. Whenever they slowed in an area rife with hidey holes, Ogmore brought his spear tip up before his eyes, looking through the green-tinged crystal, its magic transforming his vision into something that could see and identify the sensations of nearby life, instead of simple physical forms. "There," he announced, at one flat area filled with towering stones, many of which leaned together to form small alcoves. He pointed to an apparent cave. "No, wait," he corrected, even as his friend Breath eagerly started for the spot. "It is a bear." Breath backed away immediately. Te Arleg looked to Ogmore, but the younger man could only shrug. He wasn't detecting any human life beyond the members of the party. On they went with all speed, Te Arleg leaping down rocky slopes and relying upon the witch's levitation blessing upon his weapon to keep himself upright. Invariably, Ogmore found himself at the end of the line through such difficult and dangerous passages, his caution the result of a hard lesson he had learned on his first raid 8 years previous. Another reason kept him near the back as well, he knew, but wouldn't admit, even to himself. Firoch's Buir was an enormous mountain, wide and uneven, with hundreds of valleys and miles of hidden ways. But with their crystals that could allow them to move so swiftly, that could sense life, that could grant distance sight, the size and complexity of Firoch's Buir benefited not the runners, but the hunters. Surely the fleeing Umas had deceived themselves upon leaving the camp the previous night by looking at the lights of the villages far below on Loch Beag. Those lights appeared closer than they were, and it seemed an easy run to them, no doubt. The height of the Uskar camp made it all look so tantalizingly straightforward, so obviously within reach. Ogmore and the others who lived up here and ran the ways of Firoch's Buir understood that deception. The runners thought they could sprint and slide, tumble and skip their way to the lake towns. They could not. Not in time. And that was why Ogmore secretly carried a great weight with every step. Sander Shea, dirty, exhausted and bruised, stumbled into the small camp, one arm before her held high in surrender, one behind her dragging Dunan Bloch along, supporting him, for he had torn one of his legs badly on a slide down a stony slope.
"Please, we need help," she said, her voice choked and raspy. "Please."
Three men stood facing the two youngsters, their spears ready. A fourth hunter, a woman, flanked about the side of the camp, just beyond the firelight, looking for more unexpected visitors. They all had the elongated skulls common for the village of Fossach Cran, and so were not kin to these surprising visitors, and they wore that fact clearly with their grim expressions.
"Salad Tulloch," Sander Shea pleaded.
"Salad Tulloch."
The nearest man looked at her curiously.
"Salad Tulloch," he echoed.
"You're a long way from home, girl," said another man to the side.
"I've not been home since I was,"
Sander Shea replied, fighting to hold her mounting emotions in check. She held her hand out at about waist height, to indicate that she had been just a child when last she had seen her home.
"Where are you coming from, then?"
asked a third man in the camp, his voice growing weak with fear. Sander Shea looked back over her shoulder, up the steep mountainside.
"Daemon Uskar," Dunan Bloch blurted.
The words hit the hunters of Fossach Cran like a punch in the gut. Even in the light of the low-burning fire, Sander Shea could see the blood draining from their faces.
"We've got to run,"
the man before her whispered, as much to himself as to anyone else. A few hundred yards above and behind the camp of the Fossach Cran hunters, Te Orlig walked out onto a high, exposed rock. Looking down and to the right, as Agmor had directed, the warrior drew out a crystal-bladed dagger and peered through its translucent, magical blade. His vision became removed from his physical eyes then, left his body, offering him a glimpse of a scene far below, a scene unfolding before the orange embers of a low-burning fire. He saw four hunters leaping up from their bedrolls, gathering their weapons, one rushing out into the darkness, the other three coming forward cautiously to meet the unexpected guests. Te Orlig grinned wickedly, replaced his dagger, and lifted his spear. Now he looked through the magic of that weapon, envisioning the sight he had been offered by his dagger, and focusing on the man who centered the trio. He concentrated on a sense of attraction from the spear to a medallion the man was wearing, and though he couldn't see that medallion without the far sight of his magical dagger, couldn't even see the man or the camp, Te Orlig surely could sense it. His free hand motioned, sending Breath and Agmor streaming down the left side of the outcropping on which he stood, the other two warriors skipping and rushing down the right-hand side. Te Orlig steadied his breathing and kept his focus on the spear tip, on the grey stone within it that was showing him the way. He brought the spear up high over his shoulder and cocked his arm, then paused, letting his warriors cover the ground toward the camp. He felt the pull of the distant medallion. He sent his spear soaring high and far into the dark night. He kept his mind connected to its magic, mentally drawing a line from himself to the flying spear and to the hunter wearing the metal medallion. He could feel the enchanted missile changing directions as it battled the wind to hold true to that line, for the grey stone within its tip had attuned to the metal of the man's necklace and sought that medallion. Te Orlig nodded, satisfied with the throw, and drew his dagger and a crystal-bladed axe. He leapt from the rock, gathering the magic of the axe to lighten his weight as he swooped down, lessening the jolt as he touched the ground below into a swift, bounding run, each stride propelling him long and far down the mountainside, the trees flashing by him to either side.
"They'll be coming, the demons," the hunter said,
glancing left and right at his fellows.
"We've got to run!"
The last word came out with a rush of air, as a missile swerved to the magnetic call of the medallion around the hunter's neck, the spear charging the last expanse to plunge into that medallion, through that medallion, and into the hunter's chest, through his backbone and out, driving him backward and down. He didn't immediately fall over, though, for the spear buried its tip into the ground behind him, and held him there, briefly, right before the horrified Sandershe. The dying man craned his neck to look at the tail of the spear shaft, still protruding from his chest, and he looked past it, to the wide-eyed young woman, with an accusation clear in his eyes. She had brought this doom to him. The dying man tried to grab at the spear shaft, and the movement of his arm overbalanced him. He rolled slowly to the left, then fell hard to the ground, blood quickly pooling about him. A cry of surprise, farther to the left, caught the attention of the four people still standing in the camp, and before the two remaining hunters could call out to their flanking companion, two forms broke through the perimeter.
Uskar warriors!
The nearest hunter drew a long knife and charged at them. The other turned around and ran out the back of the camp, or tried to, for two more Uskar appeared from the right, charging in pursuit, one leading with a flying spear that impaled the fleeing hunter in the lower back, slowing him until the two Uskar caught him and leaped upon him, bearing him to the ground beneath them. Sandershe could only think of flight, could only hope the remaining hunter in the camp could hold back the fierce warriors, although she noted that he had already been stabbed once, and was again, even as she watched. Still he fought on, and waved his knife menacingly, and got stabbed again by a long spear.
"Run!"
Sandershe told Dunnenbloch, and she tugged his hand. But he pulled free of her, it seemed, and she spun in surprise, and saw Dunnenbloch lifting into the air, a dagger in his belly, angled up for his lungs. With one powerful arm, Te Arleg hoisted the boy higher. And now, poor Dunnenbloch cried and screamed then as the vicious dagger tore at his gut. Up higher he went, the powerful Uskar so easily lifting him, high enough so that the blood spurting from around the wound splashed over the mighty Uskar. Sandershe fell back, step by step. The man to her side went down to the ground, the two Uskar stalking over him, stabbing down with their spears repeatedly, so clearly savoring every blood-splattering plunge. Dunnenbloch continued to squirm and cry. He even managed to plead to Sandershe by name, so pitifully. And she could only look at him, could offer no solace. Te Orleg's powerful forearm twitched, jarring the dagger, and it sent a jolt of agony through the boy, whose arms shot out to the side and stiffened, then fell limp. Laughing, his face spattered with the boy's blood, Te Orleg turned to stare at her.
"Not going with you,"
Sandershe said, with as much resolve and defiance as she could muster, and she inched away a step to feel a spear tip against her back. Or one of the Uskar, who had chased down the fleeing hunter, had returned.
"Oh, dear, ugly, stupid girl," Te Orleg replied, and he flicked his arm and sent the dead Dunnenbloch flying away, then lifted his crystal-bladed axe, and turned fully upon the girl, eyes wild, teeth shining. "We know that."
As dawn broke over the dark heights of Fyrokspuer, Agmor glanced back in the direction of the destroyed camp, marking its location by the handful of buzzards circling, waiting patiently for their turn. The Uskar war party had left the runaway girl alive, tied down, naked and spread-eagled, her belly cut open from ribs to crotch, with the skin peeled back to invite the carrion-eaters. The last thing Te Olig had promised the doomed Umas was that she'd be alive still when the first bird pecked out her eyes. Ogmore thought of her. He blocked out the whoops of joy and savage glee from the four warriors moving up the mountainside just before him, and he thought of the girl in her last pose, certain that it would haunt him forevermore. Part 2. The Ills Around Her. As I wander the ways of the western wilder lands, far beyond the Barbican Mountains, I have found cultures and creatures far more varied than those I knew in my days within Hans the Bear. Perhaps this was how the land I viewed as home had once been, before Banagran the Bear united the feudal lords into a singular kingdom, before the followers of Saint Abel had created a church that would become dominant and far-reaching, although I suspect one would have to look farther back in time to find a level of distinct tribal identity as I've encountered in the wider and more wild lands. The people I have found here are separated into smaller communities, remote from each other, suspicious of each other, often warring with each other. The only common perspectives come from the traders, mostly frontiersmen who have left haunts behind, who pass from village to village, whose wares grant them passage where others dare not tread. I believe that many of these tribes follow some form, some varied path, of the Samhaist religion, though I have never heard any identify it as such. To them, the world around them is replete with gods, and they revere death and life equally, and will often incite violence over others for the satisfaction of proving their power over death. To me, much of it seems both simple and pragmatic. It makes sense, though, as I consider it, for the lands are too wild still for any to sit back and ponder deeper meanings and deeper causes for that around them. While Abelican monks peer at the night sky and try to unlock the pattern of the heavens, and so find deeper truths about the seasons and the length of days, the tribes of the wilderness look at the sky only to discern the weather they'll soon face. This might be the similarity I see to the older Samhaist religion. Perhaps these folk merely adhere to older cultural rituals and superstitions, similar enough to what I have found in my readings of the Samhaists, to make me suspect a connection. That would be an interesting question to explore, but I expect that the answers have been lost to the turning centuries. The men of the wilderness tribes to whom I have spoken claim no knowledge of the Samhaists, and the few remaining Samhaist enclaves would not take credit for them, I am sure. The harshness of these traditions, torture, sacrifice, self-flagellation, hearken to more primitive and desperate times, with death ever-present, looming and leering. Torture and sacrifice give to these people some measure of power over suffering and death itself, perhaps, as they are all intimately touched by death on a regular basis. Even among those tribesmen I have encountered who smile more than they frown, there is an edge of danger, and a measure of severity I ignore to my deepest peril. My armor, my weapons, and my magic are all superior to anything I have encountered, but I remain vigilant always, or surely I will be buried, nay, not even buried, but simply left for the vultures, hundreds of miles from any place I ever called home. I wonder, am I to judge these peoples of these wild lands, or am I to excuse their traditions as just that? Once necessary and perhaps still valuable to their survival. I can understand the brutality somewhat in the face of the leering spectre of death, but understanding is not excusing. For surely these brutal rituals are not acceptable in the modern mores of Corona. Not in Hans the Bear,
where Medalis is king and Father Abbot Brauman Heard leads the Abelican Church. Under their civilized conduct and laws, it would be easy for one to look upon these wild tribes with judgment and disdain. But what if Marcalo de Onero had won the day in Hans the Bear? What if I, his errant puppet, had remained upon the throne? I am sure that I could have justified acts no less brutal than those that now give me pause, nay, that now cause me to recoil. Does that not make mortality itself a sliding scale, dependent upon tradition and level of enlightenment? Or is it just a very human thing, even among the races that are not human, to justify our own actions and condemn those of others? Aye, for I have witnessed brutality no less wicked in those lands I called home, in the land I once claimed as my kingdom. And woe to any who venture near Anderblau Innes, the Valley of the Elves, for they will be caught in the deceptive web of Lady Daslerond and led to danger, perhaps even death. Woe to any who cross onto the steppes of Togai, for the untrusting and severe horsemen will run them down and fill them with arrows. Woe to any who cross into Alpinador, carrying the ways of a culture contrary to the teachings of the savage barbarians, for those travellers will surely find the blade applied slowly and repeatedly. Woe to any who traverse the deserts of Beren, with its merciless nomads and trained murderers. Woe to any who venture too near to Timwyvern, for they will be cast into the bog, and raised as servile zombies by the brutal Doc Alfar. These are the truths I carry, and so any feelings of superiority I might hold over the peoples of these unnamed lands are tempered with humility. I look at their rituals, their parochial, and often brutally patriarchal, and insulated views, their prejudiced intolerance, and feel as if I can offer them better paths in resolving their distrust, and many truths about their commonalities to their neighbors. In my heart, I know that I can show many better ways, many better roads, the generosity of mercy, the oneness of humankind. But I was once a tyrant king, mentored by a man so full of anger that he could physically transform into a tiger, and in that form tear apart any who crossed him. All that I do now must be tempered with the truth of who I was, with the judgment I must put upon myself, and with the constant reminder that my entire life now is one of atonement, freely offered, and that I am greater for it. I have known the demon, without and within. We are all possessed of it, and in that knowledge, so too must we be possessed of humility and generosity. Yet still, I cannot easily excuse the brutality of the rituals and traditions I encounter here in these wild lands, and their being based on ancient fears and superstitions does not make them acceptable in the face of continuing barbarity, even depravity. But my judgment must remain internal. I am a visitor here, come to find myself, to find my truth, but uninvited. And so, I am not the arbiter of redemption. Adrian Winden, In My Travels. 8. The Young Woman. The last day of the fourth month, Tumane, God's Year 852. Aulan fidgeted, as usual. The 16-year-old could not sit still on the best of days, and today was worse than normal. Though 4 decades removed from that age, Shona understood the girl's impatience. Great turmoil roiled within Aulan, both physical and emotional. Her breasts were evident now, and that hadn't sat well with the energetic young woman, who was more at home running about in rough play with the boys than in being ogled by them,
and though she had begun to bleed more than a year earlier, only now had it become a predictable occurrence. Her days considered as a child in the tribe neared their end now. Soon enough, the Uskar regime would formally declare her a woman. It was clear to Shona that Aulan wanted to savor her remaining time as a child, and this day was proving especially trying. For spring had come to Firoxbuer, and the wind had shifted, bringing the warm from the desert far below. Truly the weather had blossomed gloriously this particular day, with the sun shining brightly, the breeze full of springtime aromas, as the eager scent of the mountain flowers washed across the camp. This was the kind of day where the chores proved especially difficult for all the children of Uskar. Shona watched Aulan carefully at her work. She was the oldest girl child in the tribe, and so the oldest of any still considered as a child. For the boys were declared as men after their 15th winter, even if some still sounded more like chattering songbirds than Uskar warriors when they spoke. Now time was short, and so Aulan had much to accomplish. She had to learn all the chores of an Uskar woman and master them. Only then could the Uskar regime decide if this one was worthy to be considered for the next opening in the limited ranks of the coven. The old crone who had long taught Aulan had insisted that the daughter of Ilara, like her mother, was quite powerful with the magic of the Uskar, and would prove a worthy witch. Aulan blew a frustrated sigh and uncrossed her legs to stretch them. "I cannot feel my foot," she complained.
"Because you can never sit still," Shona scolded.
"Why would I want to? I want to feel the wind. The streams are running fast."
"The water will freeze your blood," said Shona.
"It is wonderful," Aulan replied. "It makes you feel everything. It makes your skin happy and alive."
"It numbs your legs."
"Not as much as sitting here cross-legged weaving this stupid basket."
Shona shook her head.
"You will never be a proper woman."
"I'm not even knowing what that means."
"Aye, you do not. And to think that you've the coven's eyes upon you."
That got her attention. Aulan put down the basket and hopped up, shaking out her sleeping legs. As she had been all along, Aulan remained quite small by Uskar standards, barely above 5 feet. Nor was she lithe, like so many of the tribe's willowy women. Even at her still tender age, Aulan's body was shapely and muscular. From all that running and tree climbing, Shona knew, and even Aulan's penchant for wrestling with the boys, and beating them. A couple of the women had remarked favorably upon seeing the girl tackle a boy and pin him to submission, but only a couple. She even preferred to still wear shirt and pants instead of the simple long dress more typical for the women.
"Always thinking to be what you're not," Shona whispered, and with obvious disdain and disappointment.
For Aulan's antics drew more frowns than nods among the women, and almost universal scorn among the men. She would be tamed, Shona had heard more than once, and by warriors who would happily do it. Aulan shook her head, her thick hair flying all about, her black eyes sparkling with the promise of the spring wind.
"Back to your work," Shona told her.
"Let me go and feel the wind," she pleaded. "Then I will finish."
Shona's switch came down hard against Aulan's hip, drawing a grimace.
"You could have just said no,"
Aulan said, rubbing the sting, then shifting to the other side as Shona snapped off a backhand on Aulan's other hip.
"You're to stay until you've finished," the older woman explained, her tone level and final. "And when you are done with your basket, then, and only then, will you begin your other tasks this day. And if you give me another word, I'll add a second basket weaving to your chores, and you will be working until late into the night."
Aulan plopped down and crossed her legs, assuming proper form for her task. She lifted her unfinished product, It was beginning to look like a basket at least.
And scooped up a strip of birch, then dropped it back and took up some silver pine bark instead, nodding as she brought it up before her eyes. Her hands moved rapidly, deftly, weaving the strands of bark together tightly.